Let's call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:32 p.m. Today is Friday, March 10, 2023. Before we begin, I want to thank Joanna Crissett, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Lisa Denny from the Juneau LIA, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Senator Kaufman, Senator Giesel, Senator Tobin, my Vice Chair, Senator Keel, and myself, Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first and only order of business today is Senate Bill 53, five-year involuntary commitment, sponsored by my office. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. As I'm the sponsor of the bill, I'm going to pass the gavel to my Vice Chair, Senator Keel, for the duration of the bill presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Here to introduce Senate Bill 53 is Senator Klayman, along with his staff, Emma Potter. I note they're joined by Angela Harris, who will be providing invited testimony after the sponsor's initial presentation. If you, having come forward, if you would introduce yourself and your team for the record, please begin your remarks.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm here with my staff, Emma Potter, and constituent Angela Harris from House District or Senate District H. I'm still getting it straight. My name is Matt Klayman. I'm the senator for Senate District H in West Anchorage. Our office began work on Senate Bill 53 at the request of other legislators in response to the tragic experience of a constituent in our district, Angela Harris. She is here today to share her story with the committee at the conclusion of my presentation and the sectional analysis. Angela was returning books to the Lusac Library in Anchorage when a man stabbed her in the back. The perpetrator had attacked two other women less than 2 months earlier and was released by the court after he was found incompetent to stand trial. We believe this individual should not have been released to the community. A petition for an involuntary commitment should have been filed based on his prior attacks and his psychiatric condition and his psychiatric history that made him a danger to the community. Senate Bill 53 deals with Title 12, which is related to criminal charges, and Title 47, which is related to civil proceedings. The determination if an individual is competent or incompetent to stand trial, in addition to restoration to competency, if deemed incompetent, is a process set out in the Code of Criminal Procedure, Title 12. The standard for determining an individual's competency to stand trial is found both in statute and in a long history of case law. A simplified explanation of competency is whether the individual understands the charges against them, can assist their lawyer, and is therefore able to plead guilty or not guilty to the charges. Competency is not a defense and is unrelated to the mental state of the individual at the time of the crime. In order to protect constitutional due process rights of individuals in our legal system, a person who is incompetent to stand trial cannot be convicted of a crime. This rule is because a person has the right to understand the crime with which they are charged and the consequences of the crime they've been charged with. A separate process is used for involuntary commitment in Title 47, Welfare, Social Services, and Institutions. The standard for involuntary commitment is whether an individual, as a result of their mental illness, is a danger to themselves or others. Senate Bill 53 creates a duty for the Department of Law to file a petition seeking involuntary commitment when a defendant is found incompetent to stand trial at the expiration of the final period for competency restoration, the defendant is charged with a felony offense against the person or arson, and they present a danger to themselves or others. In our conversations with Angela, we grew to understand the direct impact current statute has and how it has affected her ability to find the reassurance she needs moving forward. The legislation before you creates an involuntary hold for up to 5 years for individuals who meet the following qualifications. First, they've been found incompetent to stand trial on a felony offense against the person or arson. Second, they have been previously held to involuntary commitment orders for 30, 90, and 180-day holds. Third, they have a history of felony offenses against the person or arson. And fourth, they present a danger to themselves or others. The five-year hold for individuals who meet the standards, incompetency finding on a felony offense against the person or arson, previously subject to 30, 90, and 180-day holds, and present a danger to themselves or others, reflects the reality that a very small number of individuals, but that there are a very small number of individuals who, as a result of their mental illness, present a danger and are not suitable for community-based treatment options. Senate Bill 53 proposes a hold of up to 5 years for the limited number of individuals who need long-term treatment. The longer commitment period will have fewer disruptions for mandatory court proceedings and is a shorter period than the indefinite period of involuntary commitment that applies when a person is found not guilty by reason of insanity under AS 1247-090. As a matter of protecting the due process rights of individuals in the state of Alaska's care, Senate Bill 53 includes language that the respondent may petition for early discharge. The court must find, in order to grant a petition for early discharge, that the respondent is no longer a risk to themselves or others. The legislation adds notification for victims of the time and place of the civil commitment hearing, the length of the time for which the respondent is committed, and when the respondent is discharged from commitment. Senate Bill 53 creates a 5-year commitment option. Persistent court hearings are stressful for individuals suffering from severe psychiatric illnesses. A commitment option of up to 5 years will allow for longer treatment plans and better coordination of care. Senate Bill 53 also reduces the number of psychiatrists and psychologists required for evaluation under the insanity defense from 2 to 1. It adds a requirement that attorneys must file a written motion for a competency evaluation. It increases the time for competency restoration from 1 to 2 years in serious cases and provides that the court may release defendants on bail for competency examination, evaluation, and treatment. My staff, Emma Potter, is here, and she will now present a sectional analysis of the bill, unless the committee has questions for me at this time.
I think we're prepared to move to a sectional.
Great. Good afternoon, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Emma Potter, and I am staff to Senator Matt Clayman. Section 1 amends subsection A of AS 1247-070 to reduce the number of qualified psychiatrists or psychologists from 2 to 1 for evaluation under the affirmative defense of insanity. Section 1 removes the requirement that the forensic psychologist is certified by the American Board of Forensic Psychology. Section 2 amends subsection B of AS 1247-100 by adding the requirement that the motion for judicial determination of competency must be a written motion. Section 3 adds new subsections I and J to AS 1247-100. Subsection I states that the court may release a defendant on bail to be examined at an outpatient clinic or other facility under AS 1230. Subsection J states that when a qualified psychiatrist or psychologist is conducting an examination for competency under B of this section, they may, at the same time, evaluate the defendant to determine whether the defendant meets the standards for involuntary commitment. Section 4 amends subsection B of AS 1247-110 to increase the maximum total time for competency restoration hold from 1 year to 2 years when the defendant is charged with a crime involving force against a person and the court finds that the defendant presents a substantial danger of physical injury to other persons and that there is a substantial probability that the defendant will regain competency. This change is reflected by amending 6 months to 18 months. Section 5 adds new subsections F, G, and H to AS 1247-110. Subsection F states that the court may release a defendant on bail for further evaluation and treatment at an outpatient clinic or other facility under AS 1230. Subsection G requires that the prosecutor shall provide the court's findings to the division of the Department of Law that has responsibility for civil cases within 24 hours of the court's ruling, and adds the requirement that the Department of Law must file the petition for involuntary commitment within 72 hours of the dismissal of charges. And subsection H states that when the court dismisses the charges, the defendant may not be discharged until 72 hours after the court dismisses the charges. Section 6 adds new subsections G and H to AS 4730-725, which create victim notification provisions. Subsection G states that the victim shall be notified of the time and place of a civil commitment hearing, of the length of time for which the respondent is committed and the findings of fact made by the court, and when the respondent is discharged from commitment. Subsection H states that the subsection G does not give the victim in a dismissed criminal case access to a record or information that is confidential under AS 4730-845. Section 7 adds a new section creating an additional involuntary commitment of up to 5 years to AS 4730771. 5-year commitment petitions are filed at the expiration of 180-day commitments for individuals who meet the following criteria. The respondent is mentally ill and as a result is likely to cause harm to self or others. The respondent has a history of felony offenses against a person under AS 1141 or arson. The respondent has been found incompetent to stand trial under AS 1247-100 and 1247-110 for a felony offense against a person under AS 1141 or arson, and commitment of the respondent for greater than 180 days, but not greater than 5 years, is necessary to protect the public. Section 7 clarifies that findings of fact relating to the respondent's behavior made at the 30-day, 90-day, and 180-day commitment hearings shall be admitted as evidence and may not be rebutted, except that newly discovered evidence may be used for the purpose of rebutting the findings. It instructs the department to submit an annual report to the Attorney General, Public Defender, Public Advocate, Alaska Court System, and the Attorney of Record for the respondent, detailing how many respondents are committed under this section and how much time remains on each order of commitment. Section 8 amends subsection A of AS 4730780 to include reference to new subsection C of this section. Section 9 adds new subsections C, D, and E to AS 4730780, which add the requirement that the professional person in charge may not discharge respondents from involuntary commitment unless the court enters an order officially terminating the involuntary commitment after a hearing. This section requires a court decision on discharge of a respondent from involuntary commitment. Section 10 amends Section A of AS 4730805 to include 5-year commitments. It states that the 5-year commitment period expires at the end of 5 years after the 180-day period of treatment. Section 11 conforms court rule with Section 2 of this legislation, which requires attorneys to file a motion that is written in their request for competency evaluation. And finally, Section 12 adds conditional effect language based on the indirect court rule change.
Thank you very much. Are there initial questions from committee members? Senator Coffman.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor. So some of the concerns that I'd say bubbled up in the previous committee hearings and in the discussions afterwards were around the due process aspects of how to assure that we somehow don't accidentally create a trap that somebody could fall into and not get out through a due process. I guess in broad sense, do we feel that we have that addressed well enough? I wonder if it's the way it's set up right now is not that it's the person's responsibility to prove that they could be released, which is kind of like a parole type process, I guess. But are all the mechanisms that we need there in case by some chance a mistake is made and a person finds himself incarcerated under this new statute?
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, so I'll speak specifically to the Title 47 aspects, which would involve somebody that's have had their criminal charges dismissed, so they actually aren't incarcerated, but they're actually just being held on a civil commitment. And I believe there are substantial and adequate due process protections in the bill. The first would be that before a person could be held for even a 30-day hold, there would have to be a hearing, and at that hearing, the court would have to make findings that the satisfactory evidence was shown that they were a danger to themselves or others and needed to be placed and be committed involuntarily to the department's custody. And that same standard would apply at each subsequent hearing for the 60-day hearing, the 90-day hearing, the 180-day hearing, and for the potential 5-year commitment hearing as well. That standard is going to be applied each and every time. And to the extent a respondent disagreed with that finding at each level, they would have the right to appeal that decision to the Alaska Supreme Court. So that's the process of findings that somebody has held. On the other side of the equation, somebody that has presumably has been subject to involuntary commitment and say they've even appealed that decision and the Supreme Court has appealed that. Once they're in involuntary commitment, they they have the right once a year, in the five-year context, they have a right once a year to file a petition to be released that would require the court to again examine their being held under the exact same standards that exist for the initial commitment. And then the second part is that to the extent a person who was involuntarily committed for a period, the people that are providing treatment and care in, let's assume it's the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, if they reach a conclusion that that person no longer needs to be held in inpatient environment and they might be eligible for outpatient or in the community treatment, that's a decision that can be made sort of on an ongoing basis if their condition changes and the providers make that decision that that change would be appropriate.
Thank you. And so that's around the process. With respect to the people involved in the process, so we've reduced the number of opinions required by the reduction from 2 to 1 as far as the mental health expert involved, and we've also removed a certification or qualification requirement. So how does that square in terms of, A, that could be said that, well, that's really lowering the bar to not have these certifications and not have two opinions. So how would you respond to that criticism?
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, the changing the number of experts, or not changing, yeah, changing the number of experts is actually a portion in Title 12, the Code of Criminal Procedure, and that's specific to a situation in which the defendant raises the defense of insanity. And if you then shift over to the Title 47 provisions, which is involuntary commitment, we're making no changes to the number of experts that would do the evaluation. We're making no changes to their qualifications. The only change that we're making is in Title 12, in the very narrow instance when a defendant raises the defense of insanity. And so when that's raised, I think the answer to that is that the criminal code requires, say defendant is charged with a crime and the defense lawyer raises the defense of insanity. Under the way Title 12 reads today, the court is required to actually appoint two doctors, psychiatrists or psychologists, and each of those is to independently make an evaluation as to whether the insanity defense is satisfied. As a practical matter, a defendant that is going to raise the defense of insanity is not going to rely on the expert appointed by the court. The defendant is going to hire their own expert. And so the two expert scenario is kind of redundant in the sense that the opinions are unlikely to be substantially different, and for purposes of the case going forward, the parties are more likely to retain their own experts in the first place. So none of those have to do with the incompetency. Not the involuntary commitment is really not part of that. And so the provisions that change that from 2 to 1 is actually very, very narrowly focused on the rare occasions when somebody raises the insanity defense. And I actually, in my law experience, I actually did have a case in which we did raise the insanity defense. It was many years ago. My hair was a different color back then. And we had raised the insanity, the judge appointed one doctor to evaluate the defendant. And about a month later, we realized the statute had said he was supposed to appoint two doctors. And so we went back to court and said, look, Judge, you have to appoint somebody else. And so we appointed somebody else. But in trial, we relied on the expert we retained, not either of the experts appointed by the court. And then in terms of qualifications, the change was actually suggested by the prosecutor's office, Mr. Skidmore specifically, that it turns out we don't have any psychologists in Alaska that are board certified by that certifying agency. And so having that requirement actually essentially forces you to get an expert from outside Alaska to come up and evaluate the defendant. And because the courts have done a lot of work in recent years on what qualifications an expert has to have to even be allowed to testify, our perspective is that the changes actually basically say you've got to retain a psychiatrist or psychologist, and the court needs to make sure that they have sufficient expertise to qualify under the court standards for being that expert. And so I don't think we need to put that in statute, because I have great confidence that no judge in Alaska would appoint a psychiatrist who had never done an evaluation as to insanity. The judge would find somebody that actually had that experience and that could qualify as an expert under the expert witness requirements in the court rules. Thank you.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have an easy question, I hope. Why a written motion? I see that was changed in Section 2 to clarify, and I'm unsure why.
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, that was in our discussions with Deputy Attorney General Skidmore. His suggestion was that it seemed like sometimes in court proceedings people would raise oral motions raising incompetency and not really provide much of a foundation for that. And so the thought was that that practice might be somewhat used a little too liberally, shall we say. And so the idea was that it would be in writing and rather not just an oral motion. And so I view it as a fairly small procedural requirement. I think what it does is it creates a more clear record if somebody is making a motion for an incompetency review that you've got something in the file that reflects that.
Senator Klayman, perhaps having heard the bill in Health and Social, we could step back a little and set the context for judiciary just a little more broadly. There are sort of three opportunities for a judge to pass on mental ability, I'll use that term broadly, that you've talked about here, and it would be helpful maybe just to talk through some of the how we get from one to the next and how they relate. The first is competency to stand trial. The next would be guilt by reason of insanity, and how you could get to that one if a person is competent. And in layman's terms, they would seem to be mutually exclusive. And then the civil commitment and the mental status of someone in that process. Could you just sort of set that broader context for us?
Sure. So, and one of the examples we talked about in the Health and Human Services Committee was, the example we talked about a lot was John Hinckley. And if Mr. Chair, you'll recall, John Hinckley was charged, he attempted to assassinate President Reagan and at the same time actually shot one of the cabinet secretary, James Brady, in the same event. And he was charged criminally. And when he was charged, they raised the defense of insanity. The first step between an insanity defense and incompetency is whether the person understands the charges against them and can assist their lawyer and then make a decision. It doesn't have to be a reasonable decision, but can make a informed decision about whether to plead guilty or not guilty and to assist their lawyer in preparing for trial. In broad terms, I would just say that an attorney who is confronted with a client who really doesn't seem to understand the communications at all is somebody that would be incompetent, and where the lawyer would raise incompetency, which doesn't, it's not a defense to the crime. It just says this person is in such a mental state that their mental state is such that they cannot provide meaningful assistance, they can't understand what's going on, and we really shouldn't be holding them responsible for their behavior in the context of the criminal law. John Hinckley did not raise incompetency. He was apparently articulate enough to converse with those lawyers and talk about what was going on, and so incompetency was not an issue with Hinckley. It would be the second stage after there's somebody that might have raised incompetency. If found to be competent, then you can raise the question about whether they were insane at the time of the crime. And so that's a defense to the crime itself, and that would go to trial with a competent defendant. There's a whole another layer which I won't go into details, but there's two sides to a defense of insanity that has been divided up in one portion where it would be potentially guilty but mentally ill, and another side would be not guilty by reason of insanity. That dates back to changes Alaska made in 1980, roughly the same time that that John Hinckley attempted to kill the president and James Brady. There was a person in Anchorage named Robert Meach who on release from the Alaska Psychiatric Institute killed two people in Russian Jack Park and was found not guilty by reason of insanity. So it led us to make some changes. And that's not the subject of the bill. Happy to give you a more detailed explanation of that part of the insanity defense, but that's I'll save that for today. But insanity is a defense at trial for somebody who is competent. And so you only get to title, and then, of course, if they're found not guilty by reason of insanity, one of the features of the Alaska Criminal Code today is that if a successful insanity defense is raised, that person is actually then, the charges, of course, are over because they're not guilty, but they are then sent to the Commissioner of Health and Human Services, except I've got the commissioner wrong because of the change, but they would be essentially sent to API for an indefinite hold. In statute today, there is no five-year limit. The person found not guilty by reason of insanity goes to API and is there indefinitely, which is actually exactly what happened with Mr. Meach back in the early 1980s. And he was effectively in state and API custody until his death a few years ago. The involuntary commitment comes into play when a person who is incompetent to stand trial and they make efforts perhaps to restore that person's competency so they can bring the criminal charges, but is ultimately never restored to competency, that person then becomes, then one can enter into the world of an involuntary commitment now under Title 47. And then you have the standard of danger to themselves or others and other features as we've talked about. I know that's a long answer to your query, but I hope that provides the framework.
It is, and I appreciate it because it brings us to that question of the eternal struggle of civil liberties and protection of the public, and the protection part when someone is not guilty by reason of insanity as compared to someone who is not competent to stand trial. And so if I'm understanding the bill correctly, this goes into the latter, not competent to stand trial, and then how we determine the element of protection of the public from that person and the necessity to do so. Am I grasping where the bill works here?
The chair, yes, you've got, in broad measures, the bill does make some changes to the competency restoration process because today the maximum period a person can be held for competency restoration is 1 year. And with the changes that are proposed in the bill for people that are meet a higher standard of dangerousness, their court would have the ability to have them held for effectively up to 2 years in an effort to restore them to competency. So again, still the involuntary commitment proceedings would only come into play for a person who has been found incompetent and the efforts to restore them to competency have been unsuccessful.
Look to other members of the committee before I continue to monopolize. Not seeing others. It brings me to a question on the potential the five-year hold proposed in the bill, which is not available today in civil commitments at all. And I believe under the bill, if I read it correctly, is available only in the case of someone who has a prior history of harming others at a felony level. I'm getting a nod, yes. I noticed that the potential to hold someone for this extended period is available both using the same language as in our shorter term holds, risk of harm to self or others. Given the connection of this additional piece to a public safety application, why a five-year, the potential for a five-year hold for risk of harm to self, why not limit that to risk of harm to others?
Mr. Chair, now you're getting into the much more detailed parts of the bill. There's two parts to the analysis. First is that we have no criminal offenses for attempting to kill yourself. So the five-year commitment range only can apply to a person who has a history of felony offenses against the person or arson. So a person whose only history in terms of an involuntary commitment is efforts to harm themselves would never meet the qualifications to be subject to the five-year hold. A person, and so even though there, and the reason that the bill makes reference to harm to self or others is that the standard that the doctors will apply in evaluating someone and the courts will apply for evaluating someone for the involuntary commitment today and would continue to be danger to themselves or others. Part of what we don't want is for the court to have to say, is this standard different than that we, I mean, in case A that's looking for a 30-day hold with somebody that's been, is there based on harm to self, and then the next case is a person looking for a five-year hold with allegations of prior of harm to others or attempts to harm others or actually harmed others. We don't want the court to have to try to figure out what standard are we applying. Is it a different standard here and here? The question is, do they represent a harm to themselves or others? And if they do and the other qualifications are met, that would be a reason to hold them for the longer period, if that makes sense.
Thank you. Food for thought. Seeing no other questions from committee members at this point, I'd like to acknowledge that former Senator McKinnon has joined us. Welcome. It's good to see you again. I believe that brings us to invited testimony. Let me check my notes. Yes. If you would introduce yourself for the record, any affiliation, and please begin your testimony to the committee.
For the record, my name is Angela Harris.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I was stabbed while returning borrowed items at the Lusac Library on Sunday afternoon, February 13th, 2022. I have met with most of you and provided testimony to you in the previous committee. I want to provide details of my experience for the record and respond to some parts of the conversations that I've been having with you in the Capitol this week. My assailant, Corey Leaf Akavak, drove a dirty Leatherman knife into my spine between L2 and 3, penetrating my spinal cord. Mr. Akavak was located and arrested by APD later that afternoon while I was awaiting emergency surgery to remove the knife and blood clots that damaged a nerve bundle in my spinal cord. The stabbing left me paralyzed from the waist down and with decreased strength and sensation in my upper extremities. I was unable to live in my home until we made modifications in our house to become handicap accessible and safe for me to navigate. My parents flew in from the lower 48 to live in our home with our two youngest children for 8 months. My significant other had to quit his job to become my primary caretaker. I'm now on a long road to recovery. I attended physical therapy and occupational therapy for 5 days a week for approximately 9 months. I see a counselor no less than twice a week to help work through the PTSD of my assault. Mr. Akavak has a history of assaulting women. In 2018, he violently attacked his mother with a frying pan. December 10th, 2021, he attacked two other women. He was declared incompetent and not restorable, and he was released back into the public January 6, 2022. On February 10, 2022, he was arrested for trespassing at the Captain Cook Hotel. He then stabbed me on February 13, 2022, was declared incompetent, and may be released back into the public after his next competency hearing in a few months. We need improvements to the state's mental health system, particularly regarding violent offenders, and we need to close the loophole in the current laws that allow people to commit violent crimes only to be released back into our community. It should not be left up to the victims to pursue a civil commitment if their assailant is being released due to incompetence. Senate Bill 53 closes this loophole for dangerous individuals like Mr. Akaba. Senate Bill 53 is written to target the narrow group of individuals like the man who assaulted me. It's my belief that jail is an inappropriate place for Mr. Akavak, given his serious mental illness. But as a survivor of his assault, I also believe that the community is not an appropriate option either. I've heard the concerns about protecting civil liberties in this legislation, and I share your concerns. We must prioritize the rights of the victims to live safely in our communities while allowing individuals who need long-term care to receive it. We need to give victims more peace. As I work towards healing, it's difficult for me to live with the reality that my assailant can be released at the next 180-day hearing. I attended several block hearings and was appalled at how often individuals were released from custody because of the wait list for restitution was too long, and it violated the offender's civil liberties. I'm a firm believer that everything happens for a reason, and I know that Jesus would not have put me in this position if I couldn't handle it or help make change for others. With that being said, I intend to share my story while I continue to attend occupational and physical therapy appointments to physically heal, with the hopes of reducing the amounts of senseless violent acts. If I were not on active duty with the U.S. Coast Guard at the time of my assault, I would have very limited resources and cannot imagine the ruins that other victims have experienced. As the perpetrator, Mr. Akavak has more rights, options, and resources at his disposal than I do as his victim. My assault is an example of why we need to build out mental health facilities and our state laws to get violent offenders the help that they need and keep communities safe. API serves our entire state, yet they're operating on a very limited capacity with a maximum of 80 beds, with only 10 being designated for restitution. I've learned that the number of beds actually available have been far less than this at times, and API has periods of operating at a very decreased capacity. We must address the common element of inadequate mental health services for violent offenders and their victims. So I just shared with you my experience and navigation through this process. I share this with you and all fellow Alaskans to emphasize that we must close the loopholes that allow violent offenders to victimize more innocent Alaskans. The moment an offender commits a violent act against a fellow citizen, then their rights should be weighed against the victim's rights to safety. I understand raising concerns, but I ask that you please answer your concerns with a solution to the problem rather than just empty words. The bill presented here today is an opportunity for you and your elected positions to make changes that are beneficial for all Alaskans, whether a victim or offender. This bill is a good starting point, and I encourage each of you to learn more about the issues and find solutions to prevent from what happened to me to happening to others. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you for being here. Are there questions from the committee for Ms. Harris? Seeing and hearing none, thank you again. Additional questions for the sponsor before we go to public testimony? Senator Klayman, I'll invite you back up to preside for public testimony. Thank you, Senator Keel. I would like to open public testimony on Senate Bill 53. I will start to see if there's. We do have one on the phone. If you're on the phone, please make sure you're not on a speakerphone, as the sound quality is not as clear and is often difficult to hear what you're saying. And I'll start. We've got one person on the phone, Kathleen Wiedemeyer. Ms. Wiedemeyer, if you want to. State your name for the record, any affiliation you may have, and we generally limit public testimony to 2 minutes, and so if you want to proceed with your remarks, that would be great.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Klayman and committee members. My name is Kathleen Wiedemeyer, and I'm with the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, a psychiatric watchdog group. I want to say, first of all, that what happened to Ms. Harris is horrendous, and a response to that, a legal response, and an attempt to protect people like her is completely understandable and appropriate. That being said, we are urging a no vote on SB 53 as it is written. While the majority of the bill and subsequent discussions focus on incompetency and psychiatric commitment of individuals who have committed a felony, the bill also includes people who have committed no crime but have been found to be mentally ill and a potential danger to themselves or others. We question the inclusion of individuals who have committed no crime. If an individual has not committed a felony, why are they included in the five-year commitment period? People who have repeated suicide attempts would be subject to this. I understand that that is not the intention, but if it isn't written and it isn't spelled out, trust me, it can happen. The national standard for long-term commitment is 6 month commitment periods that are repeated as necessary. This provides an individual with the very important right of being represented, being able to plead their case, being able to be heard by a judge. Under SB 53, a person can only request early release once per year, and if denied, not again for another year. The balance of power for mental patients is very uneven. This would only make that worse. This bill should not be passed until far more research, fact-finding, and planning for what will surely swell the population of already overfilled facilities occurs, as well as a long and careful look at constitutional repercussions. There is such a thing as medical appropriateness based on diagnosis, and a six-month period is far more in line with that than an unprecedented 5 years. Legal challenges, if this moves forward into law, will surely follow.
Ms. Wiedemeyer, you're at the two-minute mark if you want to conclude your remarks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't have anyone else on the phone. Is there anyone in the room who would like to provide public testimony? Hearing and seeing no one, we're going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 53. At this time, we'll hold Senate Bill 53 for further review, and we will adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Monday, March 13 at 1:30 p.m. And in addition, I would note, if anyone on the committee is considering an amendment to Senate Bill 12, Address Confidentiality Program, bill sponsored by Senator Keel, please let our office know and submit them electronically by 5 p.m. on Tuesday, March 14. And we will now stand adjourned. The time is now 2:15 p.m.